Today is October 2nd, 2018, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Bertel in Washington. Coming up, the death toll in Indonesia continues to rise as rescuers struggle to reach victims.
Our program is not for those who need help, it's only for those who want it. So you have to walk through the door in order to get the help.
A program is helping ex-convicts turn their lives around, and we'll have the latest on the U.S. midterm elections. It's all on today's International Edition. The official death toll of Indonesia's quake and tsunami surged to over 1,200 on Tuesday, and resources for survivors are running thin. Reuters' Michelle Hennessy has the latest.
The death toll from Indonesia's earthquake and tsunami jumped to more than 1,000 on Tuesday as the scale of the devastation came into focus. Authorities dug a mass grave for victims on Sulawesi Island. They say most had yet to be identified. For survivors, resources are running thin. In the shattered city of Palu, lootings have begun at gas stations, and police watched on as grocery stores were raided. The government has said victims can take essential goods and shops will be compensated later. Access has been hard for aid efforts, with broken roads, landslides and down bridges. And in some areas, the quake caused liquefaction, where solid ground became fluid. At least one neighbourhood appears to have been completely wiped of all signs of life by the shifting dirt. People were still being found alive on Monday, giving rescuers a rare glimmer of hope. But 4 days on and the window for finding people alive is closing. Those who did escape now face an uncertain future. Thousands thronged to the island's badly damaged airport in hope of catching one of the few military aircrafts that have been evacuating residents. A Navy vessel capable of taking up to 1,000 people is also due to be deployed. But for most of the 60,000 people who are now believed to be homeless, they're stuck in open-air camps with nowhere to go.
The international community is responding to Indonesia's call for help. Among the charities responding is Save the Children. But spokesman Faraj Jasmine in the Indonesian capital Jakarta explained to VOA's Victor Beatty, it's difficult gaining access to the affected areas.
Our initial response team were en route. We hitchhiked on a Navy ship. And the only port that the Navy ship is being able to land is in Makassar, which is another big city on that island, about 800 kilometers away from the ground zero. So it will take you another 25 to 30 hours by land. But then also, we're now talking about the affected areas itself. A lot of infrastructures are damaged. Although information about the full extent of the disaster is still emerging, its communication lines are still down across much of them. But infrastructure, we know about that. Roads and airports are heavily damaged. Scarcity of food and clean water is done. It's a major problem before relief stocks arrive. Hospital and clinics are evacuated. They're overwhelmed, running with shortages of medical supplies and health staff, management of injuries, medical and health services, food and non-food items. These are what that people are becoming a little bit desperate about.
There's also a search for many hundreds believed trapped beneath rubble, debris, and in fact, some entire neighborhoods were swallowed up by the ground during the earthquake.
So the first focus on this for several days would remain on search and rescue, after which we are going to look into meeting the basic needs of those who are rescued, hygiene kit and shelter. And then moving forward in the next several weeks, we are also looking into more programmatic efforts of establishing a safe space where these children can continue with their education and their basic, you know, life activities like play, because these are another important things about children that are often overlooked in this kind of events.
What is the biggest problem with gaining access? Is it the flooding waters or is it going over debris?
The flooding water has subsided, but the biggest problem with access is that the main roads are basically very much damaged. I mean, I'm talking about damages that interconnecting bridges are broken into. the ground beneath them, the foundation where they were lied upon, shifted. Some of them are completely broken down and not connected anymore. Whatever we have left to connecting these areas are heavily bottlenecked.
The Indonesian military has been able to evacuate hundreds of people. The government of President Joko Widodo has appealed to the international community for generators, heavy equipment, and tents. The U.S. State Department says the United States will provide initial assistance and continue to work with the government of Indonesia to determine how best to respond. Among the top stories in the world, a suicide bombing has ripped through an election rally in Afghanistan, killing at least 14 people. The U.S. announces it will deny diplomatic visas to same-sex partners of foreign diplomats and United Nations employees. U.S. First Lady Melania Trump is in Ghana, the first stop on her Africa tour. And three scientists share this year's Nobel Prize in Physics. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
The first Nobel Science Prize in Physiology or Medicine was announced on Monday, October 1st. Professor Thomas Perlman at the Karolinska Institute made the announcement.
The Nobel Assembly at Karolinska Institutet has today decided to award the 2018 Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine jointly to James P. Allison and Tasku Honjo for their discovery of cancer therapy by inhibition of negative immune regulation.
The new Nobel laureates were awarded the prize for their research in the stimulation of our own immune system to attack tumor cells. The Nobel Assembly said through their work, an entirely new principle for cancer therapy has been established. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Thank you for joining us today on VOA's International Edition. The U.S.-Mexico-Canada Trade Agreement announced Monday is designed to replace the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA, which U.S. President Donald Trump has long described as harmful to American workers. But other than the name, how different is the new agreement from NAFTA, which went into effect in 1994? VOA's Bill Gallo reports.
Donald Trump has long called the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA, the worst trade deal ever. On Monday, he took a step toward getting rid of it.
It's my great honor to announce that we have successfully completed negotiations on a brand new deal to terminate and replace NAFTA and the NAFTA trade agreements with an incredible new U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement called USMCA. It sort of just works. MCA.
Trump insisted the deal isn't just a reworking of NAFTA, but it isn't exactly a sweeping overhaul, according to Brookings analyst Joshua Meltzer.
I wouldn't say it's a vastly different deal at all. I would call it an updated deal. It's an agreement that is, over 20 years old and so clearly needed to be updated.
Meltzer says negotiations for the new deal were smoothed in part because many of the agreements had already been reached in new talks for the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a free trade deal that Trump also repudiated. The new agreement does provide U.S. dairy farmers greater access to the Canadian market, a key Trump demand. It also requires that 75% of an automobile's components be made in North America, and it raises the minimum wage for those auto workers.
We certainly see some increased protectionism in some areas, particularly in the auto sector, but overall it's an update of a trade agreement. It's comprehensive and it is largely good for improving integration between the three economies.
That is perhaps good news for free trade supporters worried about Trump's trade approach. Trump said he will sign the agreement by the end of November, but the deal won't go into effect until lawmakers in all three countries approve it. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Washington.
Trade will be just one of the issues on the minds of U.S. voters as they head to the polls in 5 weeks. They'll be electing a new Congress, and the outcome will have a profound impact on the next 2 years of Donald Trump's presidency. Intensity is building for the November 6th election, especially among opposition Democrats seeking to win back control of the House of Representatives. But the polarizing battle over Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh seems to be mobilizing voters in both political parties, as we hear from VOA national correspondent Jim Malone.
President Trump on the campaign trail in West Virginia, whipping up support for his embattled Supreme Court nominee, Brett Kavanaugh.
I'm not running, but I'm really running. That's why I'm all over the place fighting for great candidates. You see what's going on. You see this horrible, horrible, radical group of Democrats. You see it happening right now.
The confirmation battle intensified even more after last week's riveting testimony by Kavanaugh accuser Christine Blasey Ford and the judge's defiant denial.
Brett's assault on me drastically altered my life for a very long time. I was too afraid and ashamed to tell anyone these details.
This confirmation process has become a national disgrace. You have replaced advice and consent with search and destroy.
Amid the furor over Kavanaugh, Trump is making a furious push around the country to help Republicans hold their narrow majority in the Senate.
Promise me, you got to get out for the midterm. Don't be complacent. You got to get out for the midterm. Got to vote.
But Democrats have some star power of their own, determined to boost turnout, including Trump's predecessor, Barack Obama.
They say, well, I'm going to wait until the presidential election. This one is actually more important. This is actually more important than any election that we've seen in a long time.
Trump will be the central figure in next month's election, likely motivating both sides, says John Fortier.
He has been out there endorsing people, working in a way that many thought when he was elected he would not be really within the Republican Party or working with other candidates. He's fully in, for better or worse, and will certainly help some candidates in Republican places, but may turn off people in others.
Democrats have been turning out in big numbers in special elections and in primaries. A positive sign for November, says Jim Kessler.
I expect Democrats to take the House. I now even think they might take the Senate, even though the map is so difficult out there. The excitement among Democratic voters is very, very high. Republican voters are turning out too, but Democratic voters are really turning out.
And we will make America great again. Thank you, West Virginia. Thank you.
Trump is expected to stay busy on the campaign trail right up until Election Day, hoping to blunt a Democratic surge that could severely limit his presidency. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
Keep track of the latest news on the U.S. midterm elections on VOA's mobile app and at voanews.com. This is International Edition from VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter following VOA News, either on the radio or online at voanews.com/encounter. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email to encounter@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on Twitter at CarolCastielVOA. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Welcome back to International Edition. I'm Jim Bertel. Pakistan's rail minister says the country's largest Chinese-funded Silk Road rail project will have its budget cut by $2 billion. The project to restore the aging rail lines from Karachi to Peshawar was initially priced at $8.2 billion, but concerns over the cost has led to delays. The new government of populist Prime Minister Imran Khan has been cautious about taking on the rail projects. VOA's Ira Melman asked Michael Kugelman, Deputy Director for South Asia at the Wilson Center in Washington, the reason for the Prime Minister's caution.
Well, one of the vows that the new government led by Imran Khan has come out with is that it's going to be much more responsible and prudent about how it deals with all of these very large investments coming in from China as part of this broader China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, this huge infrastructure project tailing all kinds of roads and railroads across China. And Imran Khan has vowed that Pakistan is not going to follow the same policy that the previous government did, which was basically to let China throw in all the loans it wanted to and not worry about the economic consequences of how to pay back all that money. So this government has vowed to be much more responsible and that it will weigh each contract, each deal before it actually agrees to sign off on it. So I think that this is a case of the new Pakistani government following up on one of its promises to be more fiscally responsible. I think it's a pretty good idea.
What is the opinion of the population of Pakistan about this, or doesn't it even register?
Well, I mean, it's complicated. I mean, China is a very popular player in Pakistan. China and Pakistan have a very deep relationship. While many in Pakistan tend to be very critical of the United States and other countries in the West, as well as India, of course, views of China and what it is doing in Pakistan tend to be fairly positive. But I do think that the government is taking a big risk here because a lot of key players, including the very powerful army in Pakistan, are fully supportive of these very extensive Chinese loans coming into Pakistan, and they want this project to move forward in a big way.
Even with a cut of $2 billion, does that leave any room for the project to go ahead?
Well, yes, and it certainly is possible for the two sides to come together and try to renegotiate the loans and the financing to allow it to move forward. I mean, Pakistan is not, cutting off, $2 billion just because it doesn't like the project. It's just very unhappy with the financing terms. So if you could renegotiate the terms, if you can get China to renegotiate the terms, then I think Pakistan would be happy to move forward. But it's true that $2 billion is a lot of money for you and me, but it's not enough to torpedo the entire enterprise.
Has China made any other moves with countries that either cannot or will not support its loan offers? We know that Thailand, Laos, Sri Lanka, Maldives all have voiced complaints about the terms of the loans from China. And Malaysia's new prime minister canceled a $20 billion rail project in August. Is this just part of a larger scheme here?
Well, absolutely. I think China clearly recognizes that there's a problem, but it needs to be fixed. I think Beijing recognizes that this pattern of pouring huge amounts of money into very poor countries and expecting these countries to be able to absorb the loans and pay back the debts, it's untenable. China hasn't really acted, hasn't actually taken any corrective actions to deal with the challenge yet, but I think it increasingly recognizes that it's going to need to renegotiate some of these deals with these countries if it wants this huge Belt and Road Initiative, the name for this global project to develop more infrastructure around the world. If it wants that to move forward, it's going to need to be more flexible and renegotiate the deals. And given how important this huge infrastructure game is for China, I think it will be increasingly flexible and realizes that it's worth its while, and it certainly will serve its interest if it sits down with these countries, including Pakistan, and tries to figure out how to move forward.
Has the U.S. chimed in on this whole situation worldwide with the Belt and Road so far?
I mean, the United States has been very coy. It hasn't really taken a formal position at all. I mean, it hasn't opposed this project, but it hasn't supported it. The big question is the extent to which China is going to try to militarize these investments. And that's why there's been a lot of talk and rumors that China could try to build some type of military facilities along with these investment projects. So in Pakistan, there's been speculation that China would try to build some type of naval facility off the port of Gwadar, which is a warm water port in southern Pakistan, which China is financing and building as part of the CPEC arrangement. Now, it's unclear to what extent that could happen. That would certainly set off alarm bells in India. It would be seen as very provocative. But at the end of the day, I think that we can't rule out the possibility that China would try to project its power globally by, you know, developing these military-type investments and not just restricting themselves to the roads and the railroads and these strictly economic initiatives.
Michael Kugelman, Deputy Director for South Asia at the Wilson Center in Washington, speaking with VOA's Ira Melman. For more on the Silk Road Project, please visit us at voanews.com. Well, we head now to Los Angeles, where a program called Homeboy Industries is helping ex-convicts turn their lives around. It provides training, classes, and support to former gang members and people just out of prison. The aim? Make them productive citizens and leave a life of crime behind. Anna Rice has the story.
27-year-old Tiffany Brown got out of prison last month after committing serious violent offenses. Born in South Los Angeles, Tiffany grew up surrounded by gangs and rampant crime.
Since I was a kid, I always was a fighter, and I have 9 cases of pretty much assault or violent cases, and it was a mistake, definitely. And if I can, I'll never make that mistake again.
A 5K run and walk marathon in support of young people like Tiffany is held in Los Angeles every year. It benefits a group called Homeboy. Homeboy's staff works with ex-convicts to get them counseling, training, and a good job.
Our program is not for those who need help, it's only for those who want it. So you have to walk through the door in order to get the help.
Richard Hassel says it's very hard to start a new life after spending time in prison. He remembers how his friends rejected him and finding a job was a nightmare. No one wanted to hire an ex-con. Richard says he is proof people can change. Today, he is a successful businessman.
I'm a product of that. I've changed. I grew up in the gang life, so I think everybody should be given that second chance.
But not everyone who participated in this race to benefit Homeboy has had problems with the law. Some took part to support what Homeboy represents.
Nobody's perfect. We're all humans. We make mistakes in life. So it's important that everyone gets an opportunity to change their lives if they want to.
To be honest, everybody needs a second chance. Just some people are in denial. But, I mean, we all need a second chance in life.
As for Tiffany Brown, she completed the Homeboy program and is serving out her probation. Her dream now is to be a fashion designer and change her life, just like ex-convict and fashion model Jeremy Meeks did. And while Tiffany hopes to continue to be one of Homeboy's many success stories, out of the 15,000 people who come to the program every year, about a third do return to a life of crime. For Angelina Bogdasaryan in Los Angeles, I'm Anna Rice, VOA News.
And turning to music, Taylor Swift announced today she will be opening next week's American Music Awards with a live performance. AP's Margie Sarzaletta has the details.
Taylor Swift will perform that song as the opening act for the American Music Awards. She's one of the contenders for Artist of the Year, along with Drake, Ed Sheeran, Imagine Dragons, and Post Malone. Drake and Cardi B lead the nominations with 8 each. Other performances include Malone featuring Ty Dolla Sign, Ciara featuring Missy Elliott, Panic at the Disco doing a tribute to Queen, and a gospel tribute to Aretha Franklin. The AMAs are next Tuesday and will be carried live from Los Angeles on ABC. I'm Archie Zaraletta.
Should be a great show. Well, you've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com and like us on Facebook at VOA Now. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Patrice Martin, and our engineer, Nashwan Kalei. I'm Jim Bertel in Washington. Thanks for joining us.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, a discussion on the challenges of political transitions in Africa. Controversy recently swelled in Kenya after opposition candidate Raila Odinga rejected Uhuru Kenyatta's election win. Sierra Leone holds a runoff vote for president on March 27th, after the two leading candidates failed to secure a 55% majority. Egyptians are headed to the polls next week with only two candidates in the race, and incumbent President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi appears to be the clear-cut favorite. The challenges of political transitions in Africa on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.